19 lip bloggers, one finalist, 5 nominees, one finalist, 5 authors, 1 podcaster, 5 Mondays, 5 interviews, 1 podcast. Anyway, the hell with it. It's the LBC Podcast!
All right, you worthless maggots! Listen up! You know, there's only 2 things that come from libraries. Germs and bookworms. Well, which one are you? All right, at ease. This is Sergeant Champion. And if you think you've got what it takes to read the 5 LBC nominees, well, you got another thing coming. Oh, Private Esposito. Wipe that shit-ass smirk right off your face, boy. Drop down and give me 20 pages. 20 pages of vomit, son. All right, privates. This week's nominee is Edward Falco's Sabbath Night in the Church of the Murata. This is one manly collection of short stories. And if you don't feel the testosterone while reading this book, well, then you can just get your sweet mama's ass right out of my car. You hear me? Oh, Private Esposito, you got something to contribute, son? All right, then. While this platoon runs 6 miles, we'll get some introductory discussion going. All right, privates. You know the plan, so hut, 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 hut.
It doesn't matter what I say.
So, I am here with Scott Esposito, and I'm actually here with him in person, unlike the other 4 nominees, in large part because, well, he kind of actually lives close by to me. But, Scott, how are you doing?
It's true, I live in the Bay Area, yes. Just like you. I'm doing pretty good, you know, We're drinking.
So we are drinking, actually.
In honor of Mr. Falco and his
manliness.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so let's get right down to it. What was it about Sabbath Night that sort of made this the LBC nominee of choice here?
All right, well, you know, I mean, my post is up there.
Yeah.
And that pretty much says it all. You know, the man can tell a story. You know, he's got some real storytelling skills. And just the way that the multiple strands of the narratives were handled, the way they were kind of brought together to resonate in different ways. I thought that was really skillful. I mean, his language is pretty bare, pretty stripped down, and he has his own style, which is interesting, but just the manipulation of the elements, you know, that really caught me. And it seemed like every story had something going for it in that vein. And, you know, the man just tells a story.
Okay, so basically, it boils down for you to storytelling in the end, or?
Well, you could say that, Ed. But, yeah, I mean, well, other things, too. I mean, I found the characters interesting. I thought he was pretty deft, getting a lot out there really quickly, and, you know, just kind of painting a scene and tossing you right into it. Well, when I interviewed him, you know, we definitely talked about that a little bit, and that was one of his big things. Mm-hmm. He likes stories that put you in the thick of it right to begin with. And that's what his stories do. And I mean, you know, Wolf Point too, which is his novel.
Yeah.
That was just released in 2005. That too. I read that in a day or two, and you know, from the first page, hooked. It definitely has a strong opening, and you know that characterizes all his work.
Gotcha. Well, what about the last question here? What about manliness?
Manliness.
Yeah, yeah. Was it the manliness, the vigor, the brio, the masculinity? I mean, what about this? Was this just sort of like, you know, did you kind of like read Sabbath Night going, oh, whoa, you know? Because I did, personally, Scott.
I
don't know.
I like to sit around my underwear and, you know, and kind of eat food off my chest as I read the book, so.
Eat soup? Soup?
Well,
eat soup?
Food.
Soup?
Well, that would be painful.
I didn't, okay, yeah, that would be.
Unless I had a very thick
bowl. Second degree burns, man. Okay, well.
No, I mean, that's worth touching on. yeah, you know, the guy does kind of deal with his aspects, domestication versus kind of being out there in the world. And, you know, a lot of the narratives, like, they kind of draw their narrative strand from just this conflict between the two realms. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, to a certain extent, it's kind of a masculine thing. You see how that applies to men. And, you know, there are women, and, you know, they're kind of playing the role of, as you know, leading the man out of the domesticity in a lot of these stories. So, yeah, but I think that he finds a lot to do with that. You know, that narrative does pop up a lot in his stories, and it is kind of like a similar thing throughout. But I think he still does a lot with it. So it's not just like, you know, the same thing back to back, which would be kind of dull.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. Well, this I will say that this. Well, I was gonna mention something about eating raw meat, but I don't know. This sort of maybe go to the whole Jack London sort of thing.
Well, only if you're eating sushi, and that can be a very feminine thing.
I had sushi today, and
did
I actually
really?
Felt very manly about eating.
Sorry, don't put that on.
That's terrible. Scott Esposito, thank you so much.
Sorry, I gotta do something.
Oh man. Okay, I am talking with Edward Falco, who is the author of the LBC nominee, Sabbath Night in the Church of the Piranha, which is a bit of a mouthful, but a very good title nonetheless. One thing I wanted to ask you, Ed, first of all, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. It's a quiet Saturday morning. I'm doing a little work. Things are good.
Okay, good, good. Well, one thing that strikes me about the stories in this collection is the way that you take these... sort of rural, sort of seemingly uninvolving Maloons, the kinds of things that, you know, Richard Ford, John Updike, but yet you add this definitive grit to them. And I'm wondering, it's a very interesting juxtaposition. What steps do you take to kind of keep things alive like this?
Well, I'm going to start. I kind of missed the beginning of the question. Interesting, what did you say?
Oh, a juxtaposition between sort of a kind of John Updike, you know, typical sort of, you know, middle-aged couples who are having affairs. But with you, I think there's a certain kind of grit that is involved with it. And I'm wondering what steps you take as a writer to ensure that that grit is there, that the stories are actually alive.
Okay. Yeah, sure. I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
You know, I'm interested in characters who have edges to them, characters who are wrestling with something or troubled by something. And in that sense, I suppose I'm no different than John Updike or mm-hmm. any other writer. But my characters often come from working class kinds of backgrounds that may not be as polished as a typical Updike mm-hmm. character. And also maybe more likely to be in a sort of set of circumstances that might be foreign to the upper middle classes.
Yeah. Well, there's a very sort of John Cheever, Erskine, Caldwell kind of quality to your stories that I got. Sort of a classical sense of plotting mixed with that sort of unusual human element.
Yeah, well, again, sometimes I'm amazed at how people think my characters are so far from the ordinary. It's kind of surprising because they don't seem all that far from the ordinary to me. I like to think I'm just willing to say things about characters that might be more disturbing than a more conventional conventional writer might be willing to deal with. But my characters seem pretty normal. They think a lot about sex.
Yeah. Certainly kept me reading.
Excuse me?
Certainly kept me reading.
Yeah. So there's sex and death. Big subjects. I try to think about those things honestly and frankly, and so my characters, I think, may be a little rougher edged than some others.
But I guess that's kind of, you know, what you're saying is kind of what I was wanting to get into, the idea that that we don't seem to think that there are perverse and strange things in everyday sort of people.
Right.
Why do you think that there's this stigma in fiction, like, you know, to sort of be kind of safe and mainstream and deal with, like, oh my God, I missed last month's rent or something benign like that, you know, as opposed to, you know what, I may not find the love of my life. Or, you know?
I think there's a sort of sense of decorum that permeates everything we do in our life and social manners and appropriate behavior. And, you know, when I do readings sometimes, I have a very hard time reading my stories aloud because I'm in a sort of social circumstance where I'm very wary about, you know, offending somebody or bruising somebody's sensibilities or talking about things that you just don't talk about in a social context. And yet, when I'm working on the page, when I'm working with a story, I feel free to say absolutely anything as long as it rings true to me. I feel free to say anything about a character if it seems to be true about that character. without any sense of concern for who might be offended or who might be shocked by it, because I know a reader can always put the story down. A reader can always say, well, this guy is not writing the kinds of stories that I'm really interested in. So there's a kind of privilege, I think, in the written word and in writing stories that the readers have the choice of reading or not reading that may not extend to other forms, other media like television or radio or public readings. Anyway, on the page, I just feel free to say to say whatever, as long as it seems pertinent and true to the story and to the moment.
It's almost like you're in a catch-22, because on one hand, if you go for shock value, explicitly, then it's going to be, oh, well, this is just a sort of a stunt, a sort of Michel Houellebecq kind of situation. But on the other hand, if you, go straight with what the gut is feeling, there are the sort of prim and proper and prudish type of readers or listeners in this case who may not sort of, I don't know. I mean, it seems to me very interesting that in certain literary circles, the whole idea of the perverse as a kind of strange thing that it's going to upset someone if the cover button is off by 2 inches or something.
Right, yeah. There's also a sense of any character that's not what's considered ordinary is gothic, or yeah, is in some way bizarre. I have a character in one of my stories that I like a lot, and it's one of my favorite stories, called Tulsa Snow, in which there's a woman who picks up a guy at an airport, and then they go back to a motel room. So now, if you're willing to buy that kind of thing may happen in this life, then I think it's only fair to sort of follow the behavior and see what those characters are about and why that behavior, why the behavior should be of interest to anybody. And that woman character, once they're in the motel room together, takes her teeth out. She has false teeth, and it's so shocking to the male character that he can hardly look at her. Now that's pretty weird and pretty bizarre behavior. But in fact, I knew a woman, a poet, who had been raised with she didn't have much money when she was growing up, and her teeth were all crooked, and there were double rows of them. She had them replaced. I often thought about that. She's an attractive woman, and that kind of played on my imagination. What would that be like to sort of have one sort of idea of what a person was like, and then have something so shocking come to change and alter your opinion or alter your sense of what they looked like? And that, of course, got me into thinking about surface versus depth. Who we are, what we look like on the surface, what we are underneath the surface, which is one of the things I'm almost always interested in my stories.
But at the same time, also, Ed, that Tulsa Snow story also kind of comments, I suppose, why do we attach a kind of sort of perverse or ugly or unattractive label on things that are inherently human? Look, why are we so, people fart, people burp, people go to the bathroom, and yet these things here in America are,
Right, it's decorum.
Yes.
And probably in public, we don't want people to do those things.
Yes.
But in fiction, when they're relevant, when they work, they belong. So my characters are willing to do those kinds of things, and I don't really try to be intentionally shocking ever. I just try to be true to the characters and to what would happen in a given situation. Now sometimes the situations are a bit extreme, but that's what makes the dramatic. The ordinary can be dramatic, but often it's the extreme that's dramatic.
Well, since we're talking about decorum and we're talking about what literary fiction, at least in the eyes of others, should be or shouldn't be, I wanted to focus on the concern for, in these stories, with manhood and fatherhood, particularly with the professor's son. What do you say to a critic who says the contemporary fiction has too many, predominantly white males and manhood and fatherhood, and really, Ed, you should be writing about people of multiculturalism, etc. To what extent does your own fiction kind of combat that perception or respond to it?
Yeah, well, I think there's a definite need for a variety of voices, and I think the culture has been changing in very good ways in the last 30 years or so to try to open up the open up our world to different kinds of voices, and that's only to be applauded. That's a very good thing. As for me, I can't write what I don't know. I can only write out of. I get one life to live. I don't get to like come back the next time and try to write some out of some different perspective. So I write about my life, and I write about what comes out of my life, and that's the only option I have. If I'm telling stories that are worth listening to, I hope those stories will find an audience. The themes of fiction remain fairly universal. So I don't think there's it's not as if we're asking for people to address different concerns. We're just looking for a wider range of voices in writing, and I have nothing, I have no problem with that whatsoever. But as for me, I can only write out of my own experience.
Well, there's also, for example, your experience. I mean, just to give you a sense of what's different for me, the story Sweet and The Revenant both deal with, I think, they're concerned very much with a sexual guilt, mm-hmm. The struggle to kind of remain alive despite this. And I know that you also grew up with a Catholic background. Now, I didn't grow up with a Catholic background, but I can look at these stories and say, oh, well, this is an interesting sort of different perspective. But I also wanted to ask how much of your Catholic background has kind of an influence upon your fiction?
Yeah, well, I think of it as a nurturing, environmental kind of influence. I mean, I grew up in a religious family. I was an old boy when I was a kid, and so that all has influence on the way I see the world, the way I think about the world, and it works its way into my fiction. I mean, I rejected any kind of traditional religion a very long time ago, but that doesn't mean I don't continually think about it. I don't continually think about the spiritual and the role the spiritual needs to play in life, and how material culture and this culture moves us further and further away from spiritual roots. All of those things are of interest and are issues to me, and I think about them a lot in fiction. A story like Acid is a sort of looks at somebody who's fallen traditionally into a Catholic role. He goes to church every morning. He takes communion every morning. But I think the point of the story is that this is a character who needs ritual and who needs meaning in his life, and who finds it through Catholicism. So that's fine. But I don't think the story says that Catholicism is the only way to find ritual and meaning in life. Basically, I'm interested in how we get in touch with the deeper parts of ourselves, our lives, and that to me is a kind of spiritual thinking.
Well, I was particularly blown away by The Revenant, and
one of my favorite stories too.
Yes, which also won the push card. I found out later. I was really hooked into that. But I guess more than any of the other stories in this collection, it suggested to me the motif that you're concerned with. That irrespective of age, we really still don't completely know who we are at times. It's very much like that passage in Philip Roth's American Pastoral that what we know, that's how we know we're alive, we're wrong, etc. Now, why do you think you're so concerned with this question?
Well, I think that's one of the kinds of questions you need to ask yourself if you want to live a decent life, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you, it seems to me essential to lead a meaningful meaningful life, to sort of understand why you do the things you do and who you are. That just seems like an essential question, one of the questions that literature can explore and literature can answer. In The Revenant, I think what I was shooting for at the end there was a sense of that a very spiritual sense of the interconnectedness of all of us.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't know who he is. You're right. I mean, he sort of has gone through his life on with blinders on.
It's certainly an extreme case. Yeah.
Yeah. But not a rare thing when you're dealing with the kind of trauma he dealt with as a young man. I mean, you'll hear people talking about World War II. These guys in their 80s and late 80s, who in once they ask to talk about it will start crying.
Yeah.
Things happened to them 50 years ago, but in order to go through every day, they just won't think about it and won't talk about it. All my uncles fought in World War II, mm-hmm. and you could not get a word out of any of them about what happened to them there. And I knew that they had seen intense combat where they were. So I think sometimes in order to deal with stuff, you just have to ignore it. But there's a huge price to be paid for that, which is what's happening to that character in the Revenant. But in the end, I think I hope he comes to a moment where he understands that the interconnectedness between everything and why that pain is there. You know, why that pain he's been running from, where it comes from, and why it's there.
But I think also, though, you know, the thing that really made that story, I think, speak to me and others is that, you know, he does actually make an initial step to break out of his routine. And the fascinating thing about reading that story is to sort of see the kind of gradual steps he takes to get to that particular place of knowing himself, of confronting these particular issues, etc.
Yeah, it's kind of brought on to him by things that are out of his control. He takes his daughter to a concert.
Yeah.
And there's the loud noise and the violence
and the flashing
and the crazy vision that he has that just sort of clicks for him and makes him is a catalyst to bringing all the stuff that had been buried back up to the surface again and forcing him to deal with it. A lot of that stuff is just I think just happens to him.
Your stories are very sort of very sort of plotted and structured, and I think they work sort of in tandem towards answering the question that we're talking about. Do you think that much of the contemporary literature landscape is too concerned with postmodernism or too many stylistic tricks that kind of don't detract away from sort of this visceral thrust? Or?
I think we've kind of moved away from that. I mean, certainly in the 80s and early 90s, where there was an awful lot of emphasis on postmodernistic, metafictional kinds of writing, innovative kinds of writing, and a lot of good work came out of that. Barth and Bartholomew and Coover, some terrific work came out of that. The Artist is the Babysitter is one of my favorite stories by Coover. But I think we've moved back toward a more traditional kind of fiction in the last 10-15 years or so, and I think most of the books I'm seeing are basically traditional storytelling. Though there's, I think there needs to be room for everything out there. And if it's, if you like David Foster Wallace, I'm not one of his big fans, but if you like him, I can certainly understand what it is you see in him that you like.
Well, I also should point out that you're not entirely, you also do experimental fiction yourself.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, hypertext fiction.
Right.
I was wondering if you could compare the two modes of writing.
They're very different. One is, I'm kind of simplistic about this, and it drives some people crazy, but I think of a kind of a word that's out of fashion these days, and that's, I think of some writing as experimental, and some writing as traditional. And it's a fairly easy divide for me. I know what the structure of a traditional narrative is, and I know when I'm trying to work in that vein, to tell a story that has a particular problem and develops through complications, and I follow it through. And I love it. I mean, for a while, I'm in the university environment. For a while, that was so out of fashion. Mm-hmm. that was so passé to want to write like that. But a good writer, I think, does what he loves. I don't know why else you would write. And I've always loved the traditional story, and so I've always worked in the traditional story. But I've also been interested in for me, what is simply writing that diverges from that and that tries to find new ways of making meaning, that tries to put language and story and narrative together in ways that go against the grain of traditional narrative. And I enjoy doing that too. So for me, it's about what I love doing, what I enjoy doing. I mean, there's nobody in my study with me when I'm writing, and I'm not getting paid a whole lot of money.
Yeah.
So I do what I love to do, and I'm working at the moment on a piece of digital writing with a friend, a photographer, Mary Pinto. She's working on some very interesting photographs, and I'm trying to do some digital writing, and I'm playing with Flash, and I'm having fun doing that. At the same time, I've got a short story going. So for me, they're not different. They're not different. Essentially, it's all writing, and I have so many compulsions, so many things that I need to write about that I need different ways of expressing. Also,
Well, the other thing, too, it's that, you know, if you want to get into a form versus function argument, you know, look at Gilbert Sorrentino's work.
Sure.
There's a lot of visceral human moments in there, despite the fact that it's an extremely fragmentary form at times. You know?
Right, or Carol Maso.
Yeah.
You know, there are lots of good writers out there who just really steered away completely from the tradition. And I think you can sense a good writer when you're reading one. Lance Olson's, I saw him mentioned on the Lit blog recently. He's an interesting writer. There's lots of good writers out there doing the kinds of writing that would have to be called anything other than, that are certainly not traditional kinds of writing.
It seems to me, though, that going back to what we were talking about earlier about decorum, that's almost a decorum not just in tone, but also in style. And that, you know, you can't write experimental fiction. Do you find the stylistics to be a restriction in your writing at all, or the sort of the emphasis on traditionalism?
No, I don't find that to be a, I don't find, let me put it this way, what other people want or expect of me is not an issue. and again, it's not an issue because I'm not getting, I'm not working for somebody else.
Yeah.
I have my own kinds of dreams and desires and wants from writing, and I'll go about doing that whatever feels right for me, in whatever way feels right for me. So I love stylists. Ray Carver is, I think, as a stylist. Both a traditional writer and a brilliant stylist, and Barthelmay and Coover. I think good writers are always good stylists.
To what extent?
And I think they go together.
Huh. To what extent would you say that you are a literary writer?
Well, completely.
Okay.
I would say that. I guess it's according to how you make the distinction. A commercial writer, and I don't mean this in any kind of a negative way, but a commercial writer has to be concerned with commerce. Mm-hmm. With what's going, who the audience is for the work, whether the audience is going to be interested in what she writes or he writes, and has to produce work with commerce in mind. A literary writer, I think of as somebody who produces writing with other goals, with more not commercial goals in mind. I mean, if I were a commercial writer, why in God's name would I write digital work or hypertext? There's no market. There's nothing for it. I do it because I love writing, and the experimentation of it is exciting to me, and with no eye whatsoever to the commercial. Now, literary, I mean, I think when you have books like a press like Unbridled is publishing, it gets a little trickier. Unbridled, I think, publishes literary fiction, but also seeks to market it to as wide an audience as possible. And so then there's a kind of borderline. You're concerned about audience, but you also want to be concerned principally with the kind of writing that you're doing. So the experimentalism is maybe the extreme other side, no concern for commerce. And the literary press, a literary press like Unbridled, might be someplace more toward the middle.
I see. So I was going to ask you about the whole sort of the commercial issues of even like a small independent press, like either Unbridled or Soft Skull or Coffee House.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess it's tricky. Have you experienced sort of like, you know, tricky waters with regards to, you know, hey, Ed, maybe you might want to hone this, not as an editorial decision, but because we are marketing towards a literary audience, and we need you to sort of we need you to modify things so that we could market better for that particular literary audience, that niche.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of that's not necessarily a bad thing when you have somebody like Greg Michelson or Fred Ramey at Unbridled thinking about audience for you and thinking about, you know, where am I going to place this book? How are you going to sell copies? Because somebody needs to think about that. My novel, Wolf Point, I never thought of that book as a mystery or a thriller, and yet Unbridled has been marketing it as a literary thriller, is what they're calling it. Now, for me, that's entirely a marketing decision, and it's been a good one. It's picked up reviews that it wouldn't have got, and it's picked up sales that it wouldn't have got because they found a kind of way to market it. So I'm grateful for them for doing that. It doesn't change what the book is for me, which is a kind of very tense, very suspenseful exploration of sexuality and material and many other things. But it is a suspenseful book, and they found a way to market it, and I'm happy for them for having done that.
Gotcha. One final question. You mentioned in an interview with the Blue Penny Quarterly that you wrote both this story collection and Wolf Point initially in longhand, and that you only have just started becoming comfortable with the computer. Do you think that despite the level of comfort you're feeling both in this experimental fiction that you are talking about, and also whatever, I guess, for lack of a better word, narrative, more narrative fiction, has this shifted the emphasis in the way that you write your fiction in any way?
Yeah, that Blue Penny interview is actually really old.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
And I haven't written in longhand since the first personal computers came on the market. But before personal computers, what was that, 1990, something, 92, something like that?
Sounds right.
That's about right, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Before that, I was writing longhand and then translating it onto the computer. We were going back 15 years or something.
Yeah.
And that was it. That was a big change. I would write out, it was a weird process. I would write longhand, but ideas get going pretty quickly, pretty fluidly, and I would write in a kind of longhand that was someplace between longhand and code, because I'd have to read it the next day, or else even I couldn't make out what it said. So I'd have to read it really quickly, or else I'd forget. And then I'd translate it to the computer. And eventually, when computers became more easily and readily available, I just started writing always on the computer. And that led to huge changes, yeah, in the way I write. I write faster. I get more writing. I get more writing done. And I don't miss writing by longhand at all. Though I know poets and friends who argue that there's a physical sort of process that they won't give up. But for me, it's thought, you know, and I can type a lot faster on the computer, and so it's more harmonious for me.
There's more aches in the hands than longhand.
I can't imagine writing longhand anymore. I mean, I just can't imagine it.
We're truly spoiled, huh?
It's really slow. And I don't miss whiteout at all.
Oh, yeah. Well, Ed, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you.